Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to today's event. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the director here. And I'd like to welcome you to the Institute's historic headquarters and our beautiful home here at 31 Bligh Street. And I'm very pleased to welcome you all to this conversation with Dr. Bobo Low, non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute and author of a new paper for the Institute called Once More with Feeling, Russia and the Asia Pacific, which you can download for free, of course, from the Institute website. Ladies and gentlemen, Bobo is one of the world's finest Russianists. He's served as an Australian official, as a diplomat, as a think tanker at Chatham House in London, IFRI in Paris, and the Carnegie Moscow Centre. And importantly, for the last few years, he's been a non-resident fellow here at the Institute. And in that capacity, he's published a series of fantastic papers. In 2017, we were delighted to publish Bobo's Lowy Institute paper, our flagship publication with Penguin Random House, A Wary Embrace, which is about the China-Russia relationship, and we have a few copies left. So if you're interested, you can purchase a copy after the event, and Bobo might even sign it for you. He also published an analysis for us that week called An Accident Waiting to Happen, Trump, Putin and the US-Russia Relationship. Last year we published Going Legit, The Foreign Policy of Vladimir Putin, which is sort of an overarching piece on Mr. Putin's mindset, and Once More with Feeling on the Russian pivot to Asia complements the set. So it's really a fantastic series of discussions, and it's a very rare, actually, in Australia to have a smart, nuanced discussion of Russia in Australia. Unfortunately, here our foreign policy discussion tends to be limited to a few very simplistic ideas and a few big countries. We're now talking a lot about China, but to have a discussion of Russia of this quality is very rare, and the Institute is proud to publish Bobo Low's work on this topic. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Bobo. Bobo, I'm going to come to your paper in a minute,
sure.
But I want to first of all start off by asking you about Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. Tell us, often in the West we talk about, we sort of treat Vladimir Putin and Russia as interchangeable in a way, and we'll say, you know, what is Russia's mindset on this, meaning what is Putin's mindset on this? So, first of all, is that the correct approach? How much control does Vladimir Putin have over Russian foreign policy? Are there other actors that go into making Russian foreign policy that we need to account for, or is the most important element from an analytical point of view to understand Mr. Putin's worldview and his interests and his ambitions?
thank you very much, Michael, for having me here, and it's great to be back in Sydney. There is a general habit in the world, not just with Putin, but also with other world leaders, to over-personalize things, to think that that particular leader, because they have a sort of an outsized personality, that they exercise quasi-absolute influence. And we underestimate the checks and balances on them. And, you know, this applies to Donald Trump, but it also applies to Vladimir Putin. There are checks and balances. So it's wrong to see him as a quasi-absolute leader, a master of all he surveys. That's a mistake. Having said that, however, there is no doubt that he exercises extraordinary influence within the Russian system. It doesn't mean that he controls everything. Absolutely not. Many things happen that are beyond his influence, let alone control. But I would argue that he is perhaps the most powerful leader Russia has had. I mean, powerful relative to what's around him in the country since Stalin. He's not a first among equals. He personalizes policy to an extraordinary extent. Now, also, he is particularly focused on certain foreign policy issues. The evidence that we have is that he's not much interested in domestic issues, and that actually has reflected itself in Russia's rather suboptimal performance in recent years, but that he is very focused on certain foreign policy issues, such as obviously the US relationship, the partnership with China, or what's going on in the Middle East, the Syria thing, Ukraine, where he is personally invested. So on those issues, to talk about Putin's attitude and Russia's attitude, Russian foreign policy, not one and the same, but very similar. And what Putin's great achievements in recent years is to identify himself as the Russian national interest. So the Putin interest has become the Russian national interest. So it's sort of exemplifying Louis XIV's maxim of what is the state? I am the state. I am Russia. Mm. Having said that, there is a real difference between the Putin interest and the Russian national interest. So, for example, it was in Putin's interest for Russia to annex Crimea in 2014. But was it in Russia's strategic interest to do so? Well, that's highly questionable, because it made Russia very dependent on China as a result, more dependent than it wanted to be. So you can see that from the whole Ukraine crisis, for Putin, good, for Russia, less so. So that's where the Putin interest and the Russian national interest can diverge.
Putin has some challenges at home with, as you mentioned, the poor economic performance and approval ratings, which are not what they used to be, and protests and so on. But when he looks at the world from his office in the Kremlin, he would be reasonably satisfied with how things are going, wouldn't he? Would it be true to see a West that is showing much less solidarity, a very friendly face in the White House? Yeah. Angela Merkel leaving the chancellery probably next year. Yeah. Would he feel pretty happy with the world as seen from the Kremlin or not?
Yes, he would. Sometimes when we look at Putin's performance or the performance of Russian foreign policy, we're trying to apply a certain standard that isn't necessarily very valid. So we see Russia's failings. We see maybe an overdependence on China. We see the souring of relations with the United States and Europe. But maybe we should be trying to see it from a little bit from the other guy's perspective, from Putin's perspective. Yes, sure, Russian foreign policy labors under certain limitations, but how are we doing compared to the other guys? And no matter what Russia's foreign policy problems are, from the Kremlin's perspective, they pale by comparison with the chaos in the transatlantic alliance, with the discombobulation of US foreign policy, with Brexit, with the divisions within the EU. And so it's always like, not how good our foreign policy is, but that at least it's less bad than the foreign policy fortunes of the others. Mm. And by that relative measure, he would be extremely happy. Mm.
And also relative to the resources that Russia has at its disposal, no?
Yeah, I think that's a more contentious point, because I know there's a line that says Russia is playing a weak hand well, that Putin and Russia are punching above their weight. Mm. I don't necessarily agree with that, because I think a smarter policy on Ukraine and in relations with the West would have given Russia more strategic flexibility vis-a-vis the United States, Europe, and China. Mm. So I think he could have done even better. Mm. He could have exploited the failings of the West even more effectively.
But if we think back to that line that President Obama used a few years ago, where he said, look, Russia's a regional power, it's not a global power, does he look a bit silly now in retrospect?
Yes. And not only that, it was uh, it It's what, when the Russians want to insult you, they say that something you said is emotional. You know, in other words, irrational. They would have seen Obama's comment as born of petulance rather than the sort of cool rationality that Obama is supposed to embody. So they would have, in a sense, felt that they would have felt, on the one hand, they're insulted by that comment and they've got to prove him wrong. But on the other hand, that America is, you know, they've disturbed its equanimity. And that's a good thing. So definitely being insulted, yet also seeing the weakness of the partner, and also really determined to prove him wrong. So one of the things that Russia does is saying, when Obama implied, actually stated, that Russia was diplomatically isolated, they said, no, we're not isolated in the world. We're isolated or marginalized from the West, as we have always been, because of the West's unfairness towards us. But in fact, we're not isolated from the non-Western world, which is most of the world, and more importantly, most of the rising world. So one of the things that Russia is doing in the Middle East, in the Asia Pacific, is projecting itself as a good regional and global citizen, particularly by comparison with the delinquent in the White House. You know, you think we're bad? Look at the guy in the White House. Look at Brexit. Look at the chaos among Western decision makers. And then look at us, exemplifying cool rationality, sensible policy making.
And standing up for our friends and allies.
Absolutely.
Now, let's come to that, the chaos, the supposed chaos in the West. We have a lot of speculation, a lot of proof, evidence of Russian special operations in the 2016 presidential election that seem to have had a significant influence on the result. There's lots of evidence about Russian involvement in the Brexit referendum. And of course, the Kremlin has a long history of backing certain populist or extreme candidates in various European elections. So when Mr. Putin looks at this chaos with some satisfaction, how much credit can he take for the situation the West finds himself in? Does he deserve the credit or the blame, depending on which way you look at it? Or is he the sort of recipient of good fortune here? Are we blowing him up too much to see him as the evil mastermind who is controlling the breakdown of this formerly very powerful bloc?
So there are several aspects to this. First, Russians are, at one level, they feel that the West is unfairly blaming them for what happened in the 2016 US presidential election, what happened in the Brexit referendum, what happened in, you know, various other spheres, various other areas. But at the same time,
they like it.
They like it. They're flattered by the fact that the West seems to be ascribing to Russia an extraordinary influence. In a way, they recognize, they operate on the basis that international relations is not a popularity contest. The world of international politics is very rough. It's a Hobbesian world out there. And it's about winning. And none of this, you know, I know they subscribe to the win-win rhetoric, but they think that's just a load of bollocks, really. Yeah. And so they're delighted that others ascribe to Russia this extraordinary influence and power. So especially when, for example, the US national security strategy put Russia and China together as threats to the liberal world order and to Western interests. Oh, geez, we're really that good. Oh, that's not so bad at all. And especially ascribing to them almost equal billing to the Chinese. Well, that is quite something, really. So that is putting, in a way, that Russia... The way Putin sees the sort of future of the world order is not a, you know, I know they use cliches like democratization of international relations and a multipolar world order or a polycentric system of international relations. But the Russians see the world in a sense in a kind of Yalta 2.0. Yalta 1945. In fact, Putin refers to Yalta in very approving terms. So there's the big three, and Russia is right up there. So they like it when the West Western policymakers blame Russia for this or that, sometimes with justification, because it gives Russia real status. It ascribes it to a disproportionate influence. But of course, the Western policymakers and commentariat are wrong to do so, not just for tactical reasons, but I think they're objectively wrong. Because while certainly many Chinese and Russian actions in recent years have been unhelpful to Western interests, and have undermined certain aspects of the so-called rules-based international order, the real threat to a liberal world order, in my view, comes from within. It's a cop-out to blame the Chinese or Russians for bringing the system down when the system itself is so rotten within, and when the actions of Western policymakers, both internationally and also in their own countries, has so badly undermined the cause of liberalism and the principles of a liberal world order. So I personally take the view that the future of a liberal world order begins and ends at home, and that it's a real cheap cop-out to blame others for our own faults. Unhelpful though their behaviour has been in a number of areas.
I would like to ask you more questions on that, but I do need to ask questions on Asia. Sure. So we might even be able to persuade Bobo to write us a paper on why the real threats to the liberal world order come from within rather than from without. One of Mr. Putin's big ideas in foreign policy, as you argue, is that Asia is where the action is, and he is apparently making an effort to push Russia in that direction. You referred to the kind of role he's playing with China, but also with Japan and India. So perhaps you could just take a couple of minutes to make for the audience the argument you make in the paper. Once more with feeling, what did you mean by that?
Well, the reason I use the phrase once more with feeling is that the idea of a Moscow's turn to the East, of having emphasis on Asia-Pacific issues, is not a new one. I mean, we have the historical symbolism of the Romanov eagle, two-headed eagle looking both east and west. But more importantly, even Yeltsin, the very, very Western-centric, so-called pro-Western Boris Yeltsin in 1992, spoke about having a balanced foreign policy, giving as much attention to the east as to the west. But of course, what's happened, there's a vast gulf between rhetoric and substance, between talking about it and doing it. And so for most of the last three decades, much of this has been rhetorical. But what we're seeing in the last few years is a much more determined push towards the Asia-Pacific. This is still very, very uneven engagement. But Russian policymakers and Putin increasingly see the Asia-Pacific as the crucible of the 21st century global environment. So it's in the Asia-Pacific that you will have that geopolitical rivalries will be most intense, not just between the United States and China, but obviously starting there. It's in the Asia-Pacific that most global economic growth will take place. It's in the Asia-Pacific where the clash of norms and values and institutions will be at its most intense. So the way Putin looks at the Asia-Pacific is not just another area for engagement with countries and organizations. The Asia-Pacific is where the action is. It's the global theater. So if he is to make good on the idea of Russia as a resurgent global power, then you have to be where the global action is, and that's the Asia-Pacific. Now, so therefore, there is much more interest among Russian policymakers in the Asia Pacific, less as a region per se than as a theater in the contest for global order and governance. And therein lies the problem. So on the one hand, you have a push towards Asia, and on the other hand, you're thinking, well, what are the motivations here? You know, is it because we're interested in Asia? Not as such, I would argue. It's because we're interested in the area where everyone else is interested in. And that's really more important. So essentially, Russians, they're sort of five planks to Russia's approach to Asia Pacific. So the most important is the partnership with China. But at the same time, Moscow doesn't want to be overly dependent on the Chinese. So there's also the quest, the second plank, which is a quest for strategic flexibility, diversity. But then Moscow also understands it's important to position Russia not just as a spoiler, not just as a disruptor, but as a sort of active contributor. So that brings in the third and fourth pillars, which are to try and carve out a niche in security building, but also to be an active economic contributor in areas where Russia has a comparative advantage, like energy. And then the fifth area, which I alluded to earlier a little bit, is the idea of Russia as a good regional citizen. We're not the malign influence that the West, Western media, Western politicians portray us as, but we actually want to do good. And it's fascinating that Putin, for example, attended the East Asia Summit in Singapore in last November. That's the first time that Putin's attended the EAS since Russia joined in 2011. And what that shows is a sort of looking to recraft Russia's image and say, we are the non-West, not the anti-West, we are the non-West. And so, but where does all this go? It can go in several directions. Well, let's just identify two main directions. If things go reasonably well for Russia elsewhere, so the Middle East more or less, you know, keeps as it is, relations with the United States remain dysfunctional but more or less stable, there's an improvement in Russia's relations with Europe, then I think Putin will continue to exercise strategic patience in the Asia Pacific. He won't push Russia as a self-entitled great power because he'll be confident that Russia, over a period of time, can expand its influence and its presence in the Asia Pacific. So that would be the good outcome, not just for Russia, but also for us, obviously. But if things continue to deteriorate in Russia's relations with the West, if Putin faces real domestic pressures as well, that the demonstrations that you're seeing in Moscow become sort of much part of a wider movement that's hugely dissatisfied with the regime, then I think it's possible that Putin might revert to the historical mean of being placing Russia as this self-entitled, you know, how dare you not respect us, and really push Russia in a kind of much more aggressive way. And then you'll have a kind of backlash. And this, I think, is the trap that Russia has to avoid of being a self-entitled. Don't you know who we are? We're a great power. You need to respect us. Mm. Now, until now, Putin has moderated that kind of behavior in the Asia-Pacific environment. Mm. He hasn't behaved in the Asia-Pacific as he has, say, in the Middle East or in the West. Can he continue to do that? Mm. And that is the question.
I'm going to come to the audience in a minute and give you an opportunity to ask Bobo some questions, but let me ask another one. Let's zoom in on the Russia-China relationship a little bit. Can you describe, tell us a bit about the relationship, who has the upper hand in the relationship, and what do we know about the personal relationship between Putin and Xi Jinping?
Okay, that's very interesting. Okay, well, let's make the general comment first. The China-Russia relationship has never been better than it is today. So now, world leaders always say this, that we have a wonderful personal relationship, that relations have never been better. You know, this is part of the sort of like usual propaganda that goes with, you know, summitry, for example. But it's true on this occasion, as it happens. It's more substantial. It's more multifaceted. There are few public disagreements. The personal relationship is very good. And perhaps more important than anything else, the relationship is better than the relationships those countries have with others. So they're kind of the bestest friends. However, we in the West do ourselves a gross disservice by imagining the China-Russia relationship as China-Russia. There's this unitary actor called China-Russia. That is a nonsense.
And that's the argument you make in a very embrace.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're not going to be an axis. Their interests are not the same. They're different.
They are separate individual actors. They have their own agendas, their own interests, their own priorities. Now, sometimes these coincide. For example, over cyber sovereignty. They agree on that. They can work together on that. But there are key areas where they disagree, but where we don't see this divergence because we're so focused on the crisis in Russia's relations with the West. So, for example, for Russia, the United States represents the clear and present danger. Whereas China represents a challenge, but also one that's difficult to define, and it's a long-term challenge. And so we, Russian policymakers, we have to deal with the here and now. We haven't got the luxury of sort of worrying about what might be in 20 years. Now, as for the relationship itself, as I mentioned, this is not an authoritarian alliance. The biggest threat, the biggest challenge, shall we put it that way, the biggest challenge to the future of the relationship is that it's increasingly unequal. The polite word is asymmetrical, but let's just call things by their proper names. This is an increasingly unequal relationship. Now, for the Russians, that's a challenge, partly because for 300 years they were used to looking down on the Chinese. And for Russians to be second to anyone in a relationship is hard going, especially given the speed of China's rise. Now, the Chinese have managed Russian sensitivities until now very, very well indeed. They give them face. They say, you know, Russia is undoubtedly a global power, that Russia is acting as a force for good, that Putin is an incredible leader. You know, so they say all the right things, that this is an equal partnership. The question is, can the Chinese keep it up? You know, it's a sort of a variation of the sort of hide your light under a bushel, the sort of Deng Xiaoping. Given that they've abandoned that, will they then abandon, in the course of time, the pretense that this is an equal relationship? And then there are sort of specific areas where they disagree. They have different attitudes towards the existing international system. They have different views of a future global order. The Chinese, let's be honest, see a global order in terms of G2+, that the US-China relationship interaction is the fulcrum of global governance. They have different approaches towards the Asia-Pacific. They have different attitudes towards Greater Eurasia, and they have even different attitudes towards cooperation with the United States. Now, the point I'm trying to make here is that these are not minor, ticky-touch differences over sort of specific policy things. These are big questions where they have big differences. And one of the areas that this could play out in is Central Asia in due course. But another one really we should be watching for is the Arctic. In theory, China and Russia are at one on the Arctic, and they cooperate a lot. But the Chinese look at the Arctic as part of the global commons. Their attitude towards the Arctic is like their attitude towards Antarctica. The Russians see the Arctic as territorial waters, in effect. So as the Arctic becomes more and more of a commercial proposition under the weight of global warming, the sheer speed of global warming and melting the polar ice cap and the commercial reality of a northern sea route, some of these issues may play out. It's certainly going to require very, very skillful policymaking in both Moscow and Beijing to sort of manage this. Final point on the personal relationship. Well, all leaders say that, you know, ex-leader that they're with is their bestest friend and all that kind of thing. And so you need to take a lot of this with a pinch of salt, you know, or more than that maybe. But clearly Xi Jinping and Putin get on well. Clearly what their personal relationship has managed to push through major bilateral agreements. Random example, the April 2014 gas agreement that had been mouldering along for more than a decade. It took Putin and Xi's personal intervention to basically knock Gazprom and CNPC's heads together and make the agreement happen. The political and personal imperative transcended commercial considerations.
All right, very interesting. I got lots of other questions, but I want to give the audience an opportunity too. So who would like to ask Bobo a question? I'm going to ask you to put your hand up. Wait till the microphone comes to you, if you don't mind. Tell us your affiliation, your name and your affiliation, if you have one, and then keep your question short. I've seen a few hands. This gentleman over here was the first hand I saw.
Tim Cole, Department of Defence. Did the West make a strategic mistake by sanctioning Russia over Crimea, given the Russian argument that Khrushchev ceded the to the Ukrainian SSR Crimea in 1953, majority of Russian population, etc.? Was it a big mistake? Thank you.
Okay. Shall I answer
yes,
each
please.
One? Yeah, okay. In my view, the West had no option but to introduce sanctions against Russia. I think essentially there are three sets of drivers of sanctions. I mean, three motivations, if you like, behind sanctions. There's a moral imperative. To introduce sanctions is a way to express moral disapproval of a morally unacceptable action, namely annexation of Crimea, the breaking of borders, first time it's happened from one state to another since the end of the Second World War. Closely linked to the kind of ethical, moral imperative is a political imperative. Put yourself in the position of Western policymakers. Could they really not have introduced sanctions? Politically speaking, they were under extraordinary pressure to do so. And then there's the third driver, which is you hope to influence the behavior of the sanctioned state. Now, clearly, number three has not worked out. But I'm not sure that they could have done anything else. If you were advising Western policymakers and you're saying, okay, if you don't want to do sanctions, what could you do? What would have been a viable alternative? I'm not sure that we could have come up with one. I just don't see how that would have been either ethically or politically acceptable. Final point on sanctions. It's too early to... People say, oh, well, look, sanctions haven't worked. It's too early to judge the effectiveness of sanctions. If we think about the case of Iran, it took a decade to essentially bring the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action agreement with Iran into action. So just because sanctions don't work today or tomorrow, but they may work in 10 years' time, we need to take a long view of sanctions. People who expect sanctions to effect policy change, I think they're quite wrong. Having said that, though, I'm one of those people who believed that sanctions were necessary, but at the time I certainly didn't expect that to influence Russian foreign policy behavior for the better. We just have to be realistic in our appraisal of these things.
We, not to editorialize, but I guess we also think about sanctions affecting the calculus of other players. And the annexation of Crimea was a pretty egregious breach of the fundamental rule of the state system, which is that we no longer do grab the territory of our neighbours.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So certainly some sort of tough measure action, I think, was necessary. Yes, I saw this gentleman next in the white shirt.
Jeff Weir, economic consultant. Is it true in your view, it's a generalisation I know, but is it true in the broad that ultimately geopolitical power is a function of economic power? And if it is, then when you mentioned earlier Putin's lack of interest in domestic issues, will that ultimately undermine his geopolitical objectives?
Short answer, yes.
To which question?
Will it undermine Russia's geopolitical influence? Absolutely. So if we think about what are the great powers in the world today, we naturally think of the United States first, and we think of China second. These countries have emerged as powers on the back of economic performance. Economics translates into geopolitical influence. Russia is almost trying to do the opposite. You know, we're a geopolitical power, and if you don't, if you're not nice to us, we'll do bad things. And if you are nice to us, well, maybe you'll bring us all your investment and it'll help us grow. So they're trying to sort of, I think the equation kind of works in the other way. The problem, I do think that the Putin regime's neglect of economic priorities, like broader strategic economic development, I'm not talking, because economic management actually has been remarkably effective, you know, because Putin has taken care to bring liberal, small L, liberal economists on board, and they've actually managed the finances remarkably well in over his administration. But because there's no structural economic reform of a kind that we need to be having, that Russia needs to be having, I think it is undermining its longer-term prospects. So at the moment, Russia behaves like a tactical opportunist because that's kind of what it has. What instruments does Russia have for projecting global power? Well, actually, very few. It has military power. It has energy that certain countries need. But that's not enough in the longer term. And just to sort of jump to a historical analogy, the danger I see in Russia is not that it collapses, through sort of hyperinflation or anything like that. The danger is that it just falls steadily behind. And there's a very famous Russian economist called Vladimir Mao who drew the analogy with 16th century Spain. So 16th century Spain was the global sort of superpower of its age. And yet by the end of the 18th century, Spain has become this disregarded regional backwater that no one pays attention to. Now, of course, there are many reasons why that happened, but essentially what he envisaged was that Russia could suffer slow decline. And I would say one further point. Russians are so focused on comparing themselves with the West. They're so fixated on the West, whereas in fact maybe they need to be thinking that this is a globally competitive world now. And it's the guys coming up on the rails behind you that's actually going to be the biggest challenge to Russia in the 21st century, not their relations with the West.
Barbara, to take up the first question, I think it's true that the actual size of the Russian economy in terms of GDP is about the size of Australia's economy, give or take. So what is it that enables Russia to play this outsized role? It's obviously nuclear weapons, it's geography, it's historical practice and mindset. It's a willingness to pay greater costs. I don't know what the percentage that they of GDP they spend on defence, but it's obviously well in excess of ours. It's a willingness to pay costs in terms of blood as well and risk Russian lives.
Ultimately, Putin, and in fact you could almost add a national stereotype to this, that we're meaner, tougher, more determined than the rest. That ultimately, Putin looks at Western policymakers and he sees a bunch of wimps. And he thinks, I can brazen it out. So the missing word in your otherwise comprehensive list is chutzpah. Mm. really. I've got front here. I can carry it off. The others will lose their nerve. The danger, of course, is that eventually either someone doesn't lose their nerve or they get it together. And that's where conflicts can happen. It's sort of that kind of hubris and leads to misperception, leads to miscalculation, leads to conflict. And that's what I'm afraid of. Not tomorrow, but in due course.
It's the same chutzpah that leaves a man in his 60s thinking that the world wants to see photos of him topless, riding horses and hunting and swimming. And
but he still thinks that. It's interesting. Well, a few days, well, it was about a week ago, when the demonstrations are going on in Moscow, Putin is hanging out with a bikey gang in Crimea and having photos taken of him. Yeah.
Different kind of chutzpah. Yes, I saw this gentleman. No? Changed your mind? Yes, Madam Margaret Toomey, if you could wait for the microphone, Margaret, thank you.
Hello, Michael. Hello, Bobo. Margaret Toomey, former ambassador to Russia. I'd like to take you back to the beginning of the discussion and tease you out a bit on Putin's foreign policy power and influence relative to other checks and balances. And maybe a way we could do that, well, an example that interests me is the Skripal-Novichok poisoning. Who done it?
Yeah.
Was it sanctioned by Putin? Was it organs of state going rogue, thinking this is what Putin would like us to do? But perhaps that might be a way of teasing out the broader question.
That's an excellent example. I don't think Putin micromanages, but that any really important decision has to be run past him. So that if you have a major... So, for example, I'll come back to the Skripal in a moment, but the much-talked-about Russian abstention of the Libya no-fly zone back in 2011, people said that Medvedev defied Putin. I don't think that for a moment happened, that what happened was instead that the conversation, I imagine, going something like this, well, Vladimir Vladimirovich, I think we should abstain. Well, geez, I don't think so. I think that's a bad decision. But hey, you're the president in name. You decide, you carry the can, basically. But I told you so. And so Putin, but the fact that Medvedev, there's no way that he would have allowed the vote on abstention without at least running it past Putin, even if Putin disagreed with the decision. Same thing in a way. I'm not sure whether he micromanaged Skripal, but
just give the audience a minute on Skripal, because not as focused on it in Australia as around the UK, just so everyone's on the same page.
So Skripal is a former Russian intelligence agent that found a home not defected, but there was a swap involving Anna Chapman, and he found himself retired, released. But the talk was, and he probably was doing this, of doing a little bit of low-level work for MI6, but nothing particularly serious. Anyway, it's clear that the Russian government put a hit on him, but they did it in such a sort of cack-handed way that you do sort of wonder what the motivation was. And it wasn't that he was a particularly high target. He had very little protection. It's a sort of one of those acts that you sort of think, well, why did they even bother? Anyway, the result was they executed the operation in such a botched way that it was traced back to the Russian government, and the British government felt obliged to act, which it did. It threw some Russian diplomats out. The Russians did the same, but also the Brits managed to get their allies around the world, including Australia, to kick out a couple diplomats here and there. Now, some people, cynics like myself, would think that the Brits took the easy option by just going for down the diplomatic expulsion route, and yet did nothing really fundamental about London as a money laundering capital of the world with dirty Russian money, and that would have been a far more effective and ethically justified approach to the Skripal affair. But look, that's another question. Coming back to your issue here, I don't think Putin would have said, no, Skripal's got to go, deal with him. I think what might have happened is that there was a general directive that you can or you should knock over Russian traitors. That's right. And even though Skripal, who had been detained, who'd been served time in prison in Russia, and he had been swapped. So you think, well, once you're swapped, you're clean. You know, we've let you off here. You're still a traitor, but you know, you're covered. Once that happened, I'm struggling to think why they bothered. And I suppose the motivation I'm thinking here is twofold. If you apply sort of you Baudelaireized Descartes, instead of, you know, I think, therefore I am, it's I can, therefore I will. So there's a perception of the United Kingdom, Brexit Britain, as increasingly isolated, more or less friendless, and plus they hate us anyway. So, you know, are they going to hate us any more if we kill somebody on their soil? On their soil? Not really. So they hate us anyway, and they're impotent. Why not give them a kick? Make us feel good, if nothing else. So this is where, you know, it's not about... we sometimes overthink these things. We over-rationalize. We think, oh, what's the intelligence reason, or what's the political reason behind such an act? And sometimes it's just because I feel like it. And this is why, you know, when they interviewed the two guys, and again, this is such a botched interview, they come up, well, we thought, because we had a particular interest in the spire of Salisbury Cathedral, you know. And you think, well, that's just ridiculous. And then a thought struck me that maybe they mean it to be ridiculous, that they're mocking Britain. It's not about trying to pretend that we didn't do it. Everyone knows we did it. And we did it in such a sort of public way that... I don't think it was. I think it was just gratuitous, and I think so. I don't think Putin would have been across the details of it, but that there would have been a general directive. A mutual friend of ours, I think, would argue that it was that the directive was out there, and that you could go ahead. And that he wouldn't necessarily, but Putin didn't want to know the details. You need to have a certain level of plausible deniability. Yeah. So he's not a micromanager, but on the really big decisions. I don't think Skripal was a big decision, by the way. I think, you know, for us it's a big decision, living in the UK. But for Russia, Skripal is whatever, you know. The same thing with Litvinenko. Litvinenko wasn't a big deal. And I think the attitude is that Skripal, like the Litvinenko affair, it'll always be there, but it's not really that important. You know, both sides, in due course, will set it aside, and it'll be one of those sort of theoretical obstructions to better relations, but actually not very important in the scheme of things.
Important to Mr. Skripal and Mr. Litvinenko,
yeah,
though.
Yes.
And now, yes, madam, on the edge.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Dr. Bobo. I'm Elena Kirillova from Austrade. I was actually stationed in our Moscow post in February 2014. Never really quite understood why he annexed Crimea halfway through the Sochi Olympics that he'd invested personally, and not only a huge amount of money, but time in.
Yeah.
Would really like to hear your thoughts on that. Is it really going back? The narrative in Russia at the time was that, you know, as Medvedev said back in the day, if NATO wants to take Ukraine, that's our red line.
Yeah.
And therefore the coup, as it was called, was the reason it had to be done. And then I'm like, couldn't he have waited for a couple of weeks until after the Olympics?
He did. He did. He waited. Okay, so first chronology. He did wait until the Olympics were over. So the Maidan Revolution and the overthrow, popular overthrow of Yanukovych happened during the Olympics. Putin did not act immediately on this. I mean, clearly they set things in train. But there were no little green men in Crimea until after the Olympics were over. Because what he wanted to do was kind of ring-fence the Olympics from what followed. So he wanted the Olympics to, not so much for an international audience, but for a domestic audience, the Olympics had to go well. You know, so it was, they were the most expensive Olympics in history by, I think, a factor of five. Now, once the Olympics were done, then put yourself in Putin's shoes. So the guy you have backed solidly over many, many years has been booted out by a color revolution, in effect, by the people. Ukraine is the most important country to Russia. So it's, people talk about the former Soviet Union. The problem with former Soviet Union is it applies equal importance to all the sort of former Soviet republics. In fact, there's a world of difference between Armenia on the one hand and Ukraine on the other. Armenia doesn't really matter. You know, it's nice to have it, dominant influence there. Ukraine really is the Slavic heartland. It's even more important than Belarus. It's more important than Kazakhstan. And Putin many times has been to, I remember in the 2004 Orange Revolution, he personally lobbied. I think he undertook seven trips down to Kyiv, only to be slapped in the face by the Orange Revolution, at least as he saw it. So he has been, Ukraine has been a source of consistent humiliations over the years, and so he has invested so much of himself personally into seeing that the right people run Ukraine. And then suddenly this is overturned. Now, strangely enough, Putin has long been a critic of the incorporation of Crimea. He had been under pressure for many, many years by the Russian Duma, for example, to basically take over. Russia should take over Ukraine. And Putin has always... take over Crimea, excuse me. Putin has always resisted that because Putin made the calculation that it's more important to control, to exercise a dominant influence over Kyiv than it is to occupy or reacquire formerly Russian territory. The problem, that equation changed when he lost Kyiv. So he lost his guy in Kyiv, he lost his dominant influence in Kyiv, so you need to get something else. You know, where's the compensation for your loss? You, in the meantime, all this is taking place against the backdrop of Russia as a resurgent global power. Well, you don't look so resurgent if your main guy in your closest country gets knocked out by a popular revolution. That looks terrible. So you have to think about the optics here. And so he basically, the annexation of Crimea was a kind of response to the loss of Kyiv. But it was so easy, the annexation of Crimea, that's what I think encouraged him to think that, well, if we go into Southeast Ukraine, Crimea is not enough in itself. Let's go into Southeast Ukraine. Let's exercise a dominant influence there. And then that turned out to be much, much tougher than he had anticipated. He basically miscalculated. He was guilty of hubris. But if I remember thinking at the time, during the Olympics, people saying, oh, look, he hasn't reacted. Oh, that's okay then. And I knew that as soon as Yanukovych was knocked out, was overthrown, that Putin had to retaliate. He had to retaliate big, if for nothing else, to save face. Now, all the arguments about, you know, Crimea historically part of Russia, you know, the threat of NATO taking over the Black Sea Fleet in Sevastopol, that's nonsense. That is post facto rationalization. That's not a reason.
I'm going to take the privilege of asking the last question, and I've asked you too many questions about Vladimir Putin. He's going to haunt my nightmares this evening. I want to ask the last question about Bobo Low. What was it that got you into Russia? When did you, as a boy, was it as a boy growing up in Australia? Is it Russian culture? Is it Russian literature? Is it Russian politics? Is it the hard men like Mr. Stalin and Mr. Putin? What, given that there are not many Bobo Lows, what was it that drew you to Russia?
Okay, my father, who was a Chinese refugee, he was caught up in the conflicts, the Chinese Civil War and the war in Japan, you know, along with millions of other people. And in all this, the first foreign literature that he read in translation were the 19th century Russian classics. So it kind of kicked off from there. So I remember as a teenager, I preferred reading Gogol or Pushkin to Flaubert or Dickens. So, and I thought that's how it, so the, it was the literary route into politics. And then eventually I thought, oh, well, this is a really weird system, this whole communist system. And, you know, sort of, and there's a certain sort of, there's a deep mystery to it all. And there still is, you know. So the fact that it's so difficult and so obscure, and that even, you know, having done this sort of stuff for decades, that I'm still struggling to comprehend it, is you're confronted by your own fallibility, but on the other hand, it means that there's this constant source of interest, and I think that's what I love most about it.
Well, there you go. Some of us grew up watching, deciding whether to watch the cricket or the football, but Bobo,
I do that as well.
Bobo was worried about Flaubert versus Dostoevsky. I think we are all the beneficiaries of the great Russian writers, and I think you got a sense of not only Bobo's great knowledge and insight, but also his humility at the end when he said it's all a mystery to us, including Mr. Putin. But if you want to dispel some of the mystery, I urge you to read Bobo's writing for us, all the papers I mentioned, in particular his new paper, Once More with Feeling, Russia and the Asia Pacific. And also, I'm going to give it one more plug, A Wary Embrace, his Lowy Institute paper from 2017, which you can purchase on the way out if you're interested. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming, and please join me in thanking Dr. Bobo Low.